This is a passage from the 1990 novel Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. The informal slogan around 24 FPS was Che Guevara's phrase, "Wherever death may surprise us." It didn't have to be big and dramatic, like warfare in the street. It could happen as easily where they chose to take their witness. Back in the shadows, lighting up things the networks never would. It might only take one cop, one redneck, one stupid mistake. Everybody on the crew could dig it. Though, in the usual way, it was too hard for most of them to believe in, even when they began to learn with their bodies the language of batons, high-pressure hoses, and CZ gas. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast, comrades and friends, happy Thanksgiving from the Bunker Studios. I want to introduce today's guests. With super producer Carl and me is Bill, as usual. Hello, Bill.
Good evening. Guys, I give you all five bags of popcorn right off the top.
I love it. And If you know anybody who's doing great organizing and advocacy and activism in Delaware, that person probably knows Kirsten Walther. Kirsten is the brains behind NoCap, because I don't really know what to do. But she is here joining us for this very special holiday film episode. Kirsten, hello.
Hello. I'm not the brains, though. I'm just a sounding board or a...
I do feel like
I can, or something like that.
I do feel like I'm just like a complain to you all the time. Like, can you believe this happened? She's like, I can believe it happened.
People are doing tough work. Got to have time to complain.
Well, thank you for joining us. This is, as promised, the holiday movie episode. We will be reviewing One Battle After Another, the new Paul Thomas Anderson film that's loosely based on the Pynchon novel Vineland. We've all seen the film, some of us twice, and I've read the book. So I'm kind of going to just pepper in sort of book stuff as we go through and talk about it. But before we do that, I want to make one brief comment. I'd like to dedicate this show to a friend and comrade of ours. I didn't know this movie was being made, and I was contacted by Benjamin Schrader, our friend, who saw it and was like, you guys got to see this.
Nice.
And so, Benjamin, this one's for you. We did see it. I even read a postmodern piece of dense fiction for this. So we're happy to give it to you. So let's get started.
And based on Benjamin's Letterboxd review, which I did check out, he loved it.
He did seem like
no pressure.
I've got to follow him on Letterboxd.
Yeah. Oh, he is prolific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's that. The reason that I thought to say that was not only was he the one who originally told me that this movie was being made, but he's a movie guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a prolific movie guy. Like all genres, you know. So.
Benjamin also and Ruben are two movie heads.
I feel like Ruben gets into more, a lot of indie stuff, a lot of like, really like the stuff that I like where like it ends and Susan looks at me and goes like, what the fuck was that? So I guess this is out to all of our film guys that aren't here,
yes.
Benjamin and
yeah,
Ruben.
Yeah.
So I didn't know, what this film was about. So I'll just sort of give you my first take of like the first scene and then we'll go from there. So there's a woman walking over a bridge and observing this internment camp or like immigration holding camp. We've seen sort of horrors like this in the last several years, like under a highway overpass, you know, with a chain link fence type of deal.
A lot of space blankets.
Yeah, yeah, real. I mean, right off the bat, it's resonating because you're like, okay.
Yeah.
I see what's happening here. And what we find out is that the woman was sort of casing the joint. The group had plans to take over that place, free all of the immigrants, and whisk them away. And so begins, I guess it's called, what's it called, 24 France or something in the...
French 75.
French 75. So the group there is called French 75. They're basically just an insurgent anarchist group doing, like, militant actions and militant resistance. But during that raid, the woman comes across the person who is the army officer in charge of that prison camp, I guess you would say. And like therein,
detention center.
Therein brings sort of the thread of the novel and the thread of the film sort of starts it off. So in the novel, it's the guy's called Brock Vaughn. In the film, it's the Sean Penn character, Lockjaw. Does anybody want to give their first impression of this? Because I had an impression of this scene when they met, and I was extremely confused. Was everybody as confused as I was?
Yes. Okay. As I was. I mean, after, you know, it became clear after a minute or two, but...
Yeah, I mean, I knew that she was seducing him in a way that was sort of, like, dehumanizing almost. She wakes him up sitting at a desk, and he realizes, oh, the camp's being overrun by, you know, resistance. And the first thing she does is, like, tell him to get a hard-on. And starts, like, doing, like, jerk-off instructions. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine, I guess. I mean, I'm not going to kink-shame anybody. But you have no idea where that's coming from. And I guess that was my thing. Like, I didn't know what kind of sort of slapstick... The novelist is sort of absurdist.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very funny. And I think I saw one reviewer call the novel sort of goofy. Which I think that's fair, but I just did not. I was surprised by that first scene where Sean Penn is seduced by the woman. They are able to liberate the camp, and then you know we see sort of some of the workings of the group, of the resistance group, of which our friend Leonardo DiCaprio. Is a member is the bomb expert.
Ghetto Pat, the Rocket Man.
Ghetto Pat, the Rocket Man.
AKA Bob, right?
AKA, yeah, Bob, that's his name later on.
Right. Well, I think it sets up Sean Penn's character a little bit because he is kind of humiliated there. I guess it sets up his obsession with what was her name?
Perfidia. Beverly Hills.
Right. And what does she go by in Witness Protection?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah, Perfidia.
Perfidia.
Which again, is a, I have to say, Perfidia Beverly Hills is a Pynchon-esque
yes.
name.
Yeah.
Her name, that character's name in the novel who has this affair or whatever with a government agent is Frenesy, which I think is funny. There's a bunch of different ways to take it. But yeah, so it sort of sets that up.
Yeah. His, I guess, like, continuing obsession with her. You also kind of, I think you kind of see Window, even though he is this, like, he's the head of the detention center. Like, he's the man. You could tell he's on, like, the military career track. But he is also, like, he has some secrets as well. Like, he has some previous, I don't know if you want to call it, like, humiliation or what. But he's got some chips on his shoulders.
Yeah, but it's, like, and you sort of, you do find out, he becomes obsessed with her. So, we have both the group planning and executing these actions. There's one at a bank. I think there was another.
Yeah, it's
one.
All like, it's just like bombings that don't kill anybody is the basic idea. I mean, I think we can get into it because I think this is the good part to get into it, which is like, this is the Weather Underground is what it
right.
is. Which I think that's what the book is broadly based on as well. Is that right?
It's never said. I think I can see why people would take that out of it, because it is mentioned that the ones that are free are have to go underground.
Yeah.
So, but it's never explicitly said that it's the Weather Underground.
Yeah. So I think it's very, especially in the movie, it's very obviously based because the two actions you see them taking are blowing up stuff in a way that doesn't kill people, but like makes a statement about a center of power, whether it be a bank or a government building or the re-election headquarters of a senator who voted for an abortion ban. So they throw in some like more modern type stuff in it. But then it's a weird mix of basically the Weather Underground and like the Black Liberation Army, because the thing that this movie adds into it that I think is interesting and not necessarily super good is the race play
and
element of
yes,
it.
And I think the scene
I didn't really want to get into that yet, but now we should. We actually should.
Because I think that scene, the scene you're mentioning with Perfidia Beverly Hills and Stephen Lockjaw, I think the two big points of discussion in this movie that scene illustrates, one is just like the batshit psychosexual tendencies of fascists that we see through Stephen Lockjaw's character starting in that scene, but throughout the movie. And then the second is the choices that the movie makes in portraying Perfidia Beverly Hills. And I know that like some people have different takes on, is this exploitative or does she have agency or power in this situation?
Well, here's what I'll ask you, because there is another piece of this.
And then there's
that
also,
factors in. Yeah. She's also the partner or the girlfriend of
the Ghetto Pat.
So,
because it seemed to me, it does kind of seem like she is a racist caricature of a Black liberation,
like hypersexualized.
Yeah. Yes, hypersexualized.
Yeah, she can't get through action without having to have sex.
Yes.
Yeah. They have sex in the car when he's trying to do sort of like bomb stuff, like detonation stuff. There's something else going on where they're trying to learn about something, or maybe they're just watching TV. I forget. Because that's a big thing in the book that they don't really do in the film, is like there's this tone of like the TV's like entrancing us all, mm-hmm. which I thought would have been interesting to try to do for the film, but they didn't. But yeah, she's always just like, I want to fuck. Which again, okay.
Yeah.
It is a little tropey. And also, you don't really get where that's coming from. Like, again, going back to the very first scene, where that's like a crazy sort of thing to do, but you have no, and you never really get information about, like, how did they get there? Like, I guess with Lockjaw, you kind of do, because, like you said, it's a characteristic that person would have. Mm-hmm. But he's a freak, all
he's
right.
He's a freak.
He's really something.
He's not gay. He makes it clear.
Look, we'll get to that. Yeah. We'll get to that. But yeah, so we have Perfidia, who is basically dating someone or a partner with someone in the group, who is carrying on, who she goes and she visits at another time, the Lockjaw character.
Yeah, so what happens is that she gets caught with a bomb. And he's like, I don't care about the bomb. I need you to meet me here. And then when they get to that scene, it's basically like they have another sexual encounter. And so that's also part of the like unclearness of it, which is like, was this a consensual thing? Because it kind of comes off as like, well, I'm going to bust you unless you do this thing. It's implied sexual assault.
Yeah, the whole thing, there's implications there that aren't necessarily clear because again, then it becomes a thing where the Lockjaw character gets obsessed with her, regardless of the sort of the policing of it. And it becomes where he's, you know, has that obsession with her. But you don't really see where that. I guess he just gets obsessed with her because, like, you don't really.
Yeah, because like she humiliated him, and he's obsessed with black girls. Because that's one
like
of the
he's
classic
obsessed
lines.
With, right. Yeah.
He tracks down Leonardo DiCaprio's character, and just like in a grocery line, just says, "Do you like black girls? I love them." So he just like, this like psychosexual thing.
And the goofiness of fascism, too, like, is something that's very
He unfortunately
apparent.
Does a really good job.
It's cartoonish.
By him also being a not good person.
Well, can I ask about, I agree with you, like, the hypersexualization and the caricatureness of Perfidia's character, but I didn't think that it was PTA, the director, doing it. I thought it was almost like an homage to movies decades ago that would do that when it was so on the nose. So I totally agree with you, but I had not really thought of that until now.
Another piece is, like, the fact that she is contrasted with like the other main black woman character of the French 75 who is literally a nun.
Right.
And, or like, or maybe it's not literally a nun. None adjacent.
In the book, they're in a monastery, but they're ninjets.
Well, that was kind of the same sort of thing. Yeah, they really doing martial arts.
That's one of the things that does line up. And they get into the background.
It felt a little virgin or hoary to me in a way that I was like, I don't know how I feel about this.
Yeah. So I think if we want to walk through the rest of the like intro set, because there's like a 30-minute section at the start that sort of gives the backstory, and then it gets into the movie.
Yep.
The first 30 minutes are probably the most interesting part, and the part that I didn't like as much, especially on the first watching.
Can I ask you guys, what year did you... I have not looked this up independently, because I don't know if it's even in the wiki, but like, I was kind of stumped at where to put the year in the first half, the first act of and because obviously later there is a 16 or so year
fifteen
gap. So did you guys have any, when you were watching it, were you like, well, obviously it looks like the news right now, like the ICE detention center, all of the masked up. It's like, I know that they were doing that a year or two ago, but it felt so like bone chilling to me because it like was, when I watched it a couple weeks ago, that was literally what was on the news that night.
Yep.
But it's also kind of cool because like there are no real cell phones in the movie. So it's also like, it's kind
there's,
of,
there's one cell phone.
There's one cell phone.
God damn it. I told you.
But anyway, was it like 2015? Was it 2020?
Yeah,
was it
2025? Well, I think the first part was 2025 and the second part was also 2025 was kind of the vibe.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you have to suspend disbelief.
Yes.
Because the main part of the, what kind of culminates the first act, I think, is that Perfidia becomes pregnant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Leonardo DiCaprio character and Perfidia actually sort of settle down with the kid, who's a baby. But
she's miserable and she hates it. And she's like, well, why doesn't he care about me anymore? And there's like a weird
classic story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You love the baby more than me.
And then they
postpartum
do,
sort of situation.
Yeah.
And then they do the 1981 Brings robbery. So bringing it back to the actual history of it, like,
So
at this point they've only been doing like, as far as we've seen, they've only been doing bombings or rescuing like immigrants from detention camps. And now they rob a bank. And Perfidia shoots a black guard who
was about
like,
to shoot someone else.
He had like
breach of
he was like doing something, reached for the gun.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
kills him. They all run off. She gets, I think she's the only one who gets caught, or maybe her or one or two other people. And then while she's in jail, Lockjaw comes and basically says, "Oh, I can get you out of this if you give up everybody." And cut to montage of all the other French 75 people getting gunned down or...
Everybody's getting clipped.
They're getting clipped like immediately.
Yeah.
Alana Haim loses her wig.
Yeah. Was she the one in the grocery store?
Yeah.
Omar
or Avon Barksdale from The Wire.
Yeah.
Goes into... He went out pretty cool. That was a good...
One of the Haim sisters gets it.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's getting it.
Yeah. And then she goes into witness protection, but then she runs off.
Yeah, so she flees witness protection.
And goes to Mexico, and then...
Oh, can I just say the one detail at the witness protection house that, like, that's what threw me off on what year it was, because there, Lockjaw shows up in what I would describe as a Buxton-esque pickup truck.
Oh, my God, the outfit.
Yeah.
And the outfit.
The outfit we were noting that when we...
His outfits are so good. They're just so chintzy and... Ill-draped, ill-fitting.
Yeah, and a massive truck.
Yeah.
And the massive truck completely threw me off.
It should be said that the massive truck... And like again, when I'm at the film, I don't see it that great. I just remember him wearing that like light color.
Yeah.
He's jacked. He got real jacked for it. So he's jacked up and he's wearing this light color jacket. So it didn't immediately jump to mind the Buxton thing, but I can see that. But Buxton is a little bit more well-dressed. So tailored. He's got some tailored shoes.
Another really cool physical feature of Stephen Lockjaw is... He has, I guess I would describe them as reverse turf bangs.
Yeah.
They're much longer than the rest of his hair.
Right.
And he has them. There's a really good scene we'll talk about later, I guess, when he's in the elevator going to visit the rest of the Christmas adventures. When he takes his comb out, he's wearing just like this really shitty, wrinkled, cheap outfit.
He looks like he's wearing his dad's blazer.
Yes,
when he dresses up for the for the Christmas club,
and he licks the comb. Yeah. He's like running it through his weird bangs and trying to get ready. And then we find out. Well, sorry, that's a really good bit. So I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but
yeah. So the
basically the rest of the group was embarrassed to be seen with him.
Yes.
Due to his looking like absolute shit.
So that is the first act is Perfidia fleeing witness protection. Many of the resistance group are killed.
Yep.
But the Leonardo DiCaprio character with their daughter,
yep.
And some others are able to flee. They get ready and they go underground.
And so I think, kind of, yeah. Well, given that we're at the end of that, I do want to point out something that I think we can kind of come back to throughout. So one is, and I said this when we had briefly talked about this before, if you want to get a real story of what this actually was like, Mother Country Radicals, a crooked media podcast somehow, but it's the son of Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, records, like, he interviews his parents, he interviews a bunch of other former Weather Underground people, a bunch of Black Liberation Army people and their kids, and, like, tells a story of the Weather Underground and sort of the effects of it, and it's very, very good. So, one, I just want to pitch that because I have a couple lines from that at the end that I want to read that I feel like kind of sums up one of the points of this movie. But another piece, so with Perfidia Beverly Hills, obviously she's, so there was no race stuff in the novel, right?
No. The only, so as far as you know, everybody's white. I mean, there's no,
it could be something else, but no.
There, it's the only sort of racial thing in the novel is, well, there's a couple. One is that the ninjets, the nuns, they actually go very deep into how they got to, like they follow a specific school of Japanese martial arts. So there's like a lot, like a little bit takes place in Japan, so you can understand how these women, like they, you know, and a little bit about that. And there is another, there are a few like Hispanic characters, but not, they're just funny, you know, there's no like, you know, another agent, this guy Hector is, he's following them too from the government, but he knows the Lockjaw character, Vond.
Yeah.
He's actually addicted to television.
Hmm.
I wish I would have written it down. There's an acronym for the government agency that's giving him like therapy to try to get him off, and it's NEVER, never. He actually, later on in the book, he's driving somewhere and he has to take a long drive from like Northern California to Southern California, and he puts a TV in the back seat and he puts his rear view mirror so he can watch the TV in his rear view mirror. But no, there's no explicitly or even like implicitly sort of racial dynamic in the book at all.
Because when looking at the Perfidia Beverly Hills character, it's very hard not to think about Assata Shakur. Who is also like a Black revolutionary who went underground and is a different situation and had a kid. And in her case, she escaped, or she was basically rescued from prison and then fled the country and got asylum in Cuba. But like, it's a very similar, there's a lot of very similar like narrative points in that. So it makes me think there is at least some inspiration there. And also, just sort of a weird coincidence, Assata Shakur died on September 15th, and the movie got released on September 25th. Movie got released on September 26th. So it might just be like it just happened to work out that way. But that is one of the things that makes me feel a bit weird about the portrayal of Perfidia, of just like they talk about, oh, she comes from a line of revolutionaries. That's just a one-off, like a thrown-out line that they never come back to.
Well, they do show her mom. They do show her mom when she's leaving in a when she's running out of town, and that is it's funny how I'm the one defending the film. That's in the book too. That her family. So in that case, Zoid, but you know, they're his in-laws, are revolutionaries too. That's in there.
But you know, in this movie, she is like, totally driven by libido. She says a bit, like all these kind of revolutionary catchphrases to like get out of mothering her child.
Yeah.
And then, classic. You know, she's the one that gets everybody in trouble by shooting the guard, which why compared to the Brinks robbery, that was one of the things that in 1981, some of the few Weather Underground people and Black Liberation Army people that are still underground, they have this robbery. They accidentally kill a few. Well, I mean, in in the course as a result of what they're doing, they kill a few people, and that's what
collateral damage, I think, is how.
So there's a very clear like lineup there as well. And then she betrays her friends, and like that something that the Weather Underground and Black Liberation Army people were pretty good at was not ratting. And she rats, and that's kind of what gets her off. And so like the comparison there with Assata Shakur, who like went to jail for a likely false accusation of what she did, which like she was charged with killing a cop, and who also one of the people they interview in this podcast is Kikuya Shakur, who is her daughter, who was she was born in prison, and she was 5 when her mother escaped prison. And as soon as Assata got to Cuba, she brought Kikuya with her. And so like she actually did make an effort for several years to be a mother to her daughter. Whereas you have Perfidia like very intentionally being like, I don't want to be a mother. Like you're trying to like, you know, get very jealous. So just the, that particular element of it, like all the similarities to like a real revolutionary person and yet cast in possibly the most negative light possible, that all just like slightly rubbed me the wrong way given the context, but also that's purely, you know, reading into it as opposed to like what was in the text itself.
I feel like one of my, and it's not even a critique, it's just an observation in the movie, is that everything was played for like a gag,
mm-hmm.
or yes. played up, and yeah. it was goofy, and so I think what you're saying is correct, like, and
well,
you never
PTA
and you,
also and, like pretty famously. Claims to not make political movies, and
yeah, so that's it. So yeah. he's just stripping all of that out.
Yeah, because which, like, I think as Carl and I have talked about, in that in and of itself is a political choice,
right?
So yes. yeah, it. I think it to me that would track with how all of these portrayals are ultimately over exaggerated and goofy and gags. Yeah. But yeah, it.
But it's. It's
still
an
speaking,
intentional choice, but,
yes.
but it's saying something.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's like still stuff that it's speaking to that because feels what, a little bit
what
off.
I noticed, so there's a tension in the movie and in the book about, so now the daughter is growing, was a baby when her mother left, and is now a teenager.
Yeah, cut to Steely Dan song.
Yeah,
karate.
He is watching the Battle of Algiers. If you guys
yes.
caught that,
yep.
great one there.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Excellent. Excellent.
Do you mind if we just reflect on the French 75 for like a minute? Because sure. I thought it was interesting. They kind of start out that Act One with like some like a lot of successes. Like they seem unstoppable.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job. Yeah.
They do a pretty good job. But then I was just thinking it was kind of funny. Is like when they do have to go more underground, and I guess also put a pin in that, was the Weather Underground diverse? Or
no, it was all white.
All white, that's what I thought.
They worked with a lot of different, so one of the things that also comes up in the podcast, which I'll reference several times, it's a good listen, has good history, and actually talks about the ideology of the revolution that they were covering, as opposed to this, which is kind of just like, you know. What was the Perfidia system? I was like, oh, you know, it's like free love, free bodies, and freedom to do whatever the fuck we want, or like...
I think what Which, this like, does, you know, this probably, book kind of pushes the White Weather Underground
yeah,
and other black
Yeah, so it just combines
kind of,
all the
it
different...
It just sort of jams them all together.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, one of the things they mentioned...
The Jane Collective. Yeah.
Because the other thing is what you find out...
They just combine all the undergrounds that did exist into, like, one organization, basically.
Yeah. yeah.
This is all happening in a milieu of, like, the 60s in the book, of, like, fuck Nixon, we do drugs, you know, we're anti-war, all of that stuff. But there's never anything specific they do. The only thing specific is that Frenesy Gates, the mother of the Perfidia character, was in basically a radical film collective, and obviously supported all of this stuff, but was into a bunch of different stuff. But they never like there's never a bomb sequence or a rescue sequence or a bank robbery sequence. It's just sort of in the air, you know, stuff's happening. I did pick out a little thing to start this because I want to talk about this tension, which is the middle, which is sort of like the chase. This what happened in the film is similar to what is in the book. The daughter in the book is called Prairie. She is actually
that
just
is a like, great hippie. Like our parents were hippies, we named you a hippie name.
Right, classic. And she. Just like, well, maybe we should do this first. let's just talk about her being sort of whisked away, because that happens in the book too, but it happens in the film in a pretty strange way. She's whisked away, so they're you know, obviously they're underground, but they're looking.
Well, no, let's start by talking about the Christmas Adventures.
Oh, okay.
That, you need to understand that to know why she gets whisked away.
Yes, you know what? We cannot skip the Christmas Adventures.
Very important part of the movie, and my favorite element of the movie, I think. Or no, second favorite element. I do like. We'll talk about the Michelle del Toro character in that sort of.
Yeah. Well, let me read this then, because this is another thing, and I only have a few of them. And this was the way that Pynchon described Brock Vaughn character, the Lockjaw character, as a. I mean, it's a. What you realize is it's just a very interesting passage to describe just reactionary, you know, freak. What really got his attention was the Lambrosian concept of Mesuroism. Radical militants, revolutionaries, however they styled themselves, all sinned against this deep, organic human principle, which Lambrosio named after the Greek for hatred of anything new. It operated as a feedback device to keep societies coming along safely, coherently. Any sudden attempt to change things would be answered by an immediate messianistic backlash, not only from the state, but from the people themselves. Nixon's election in 68 seeming to Brock a perfect example of this. So that's the background of the character in the book. But he is approached, once Perfidia in the film escapes, he is approached by a group of really, really interesting guys. The Christmas Adventurers Club.
Yep.
Which, again, there are stories about this kind of stuff in real life. There's one out in Northern California. There's the Safari Club, famously helping do coups all over the world in Cuba, Africa, and other places. So this is sort of like a run-up of those like secret groups of just like racist corporate white guys.
Yeah. So they never fully explain what's going on with them, but you get the sense it's like fairly wealthy, influential people, probably in government and business.
But maybe also even more powerful than that.
Yeah.
that like might be their day job, or like, you know, like they might be on the board of directors of Wilmington Trust or something. But there was like another level, even above this like powerful general or whatever he is at that point. It is like they are exponentially more powerful than him.
Yeah. I mean, when they approach the general, there's like, I think there's a senator in the room, but that was just like incidental.
Yes.
Like, no, there's a senator in here. He's just another guy that's in here. Yeah, so you can tell that there's, you know, this is like a secret, sort of very fishy, bad operation. And, you know, I guess in the first, you can tell pretty right off when they start speaking. It's just, you know, it's pretty virulently racist stuff, you know, so you can tell.
Yeah, and also that they see Lockjaw as like...
clearly inferior.
A hick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The contempt they had for him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but clearly he had been like, he had heard about it and was angling for it.
Oh, yeah.
Because the guy who I just realized is the one who was on the Conan show doing the Jeffrey Epstein bit of the Jeffrey Epstein, the New York financier, that guy apparently is Sandy.
Who's great. Does not speak many lines, but just is clearly so dumb and
knocks it out of the park.
So I feel like we got to do this, right? We got to do this.
This is technically at the end, but. I think it gets the idea.
All right.
So this exchange is among three people. Virgil Throckmorton, which is just a great
name.
Is, again, amazing. Once again, that is an amazing.
And also Tony Goldwyn, really good. He creeped me out so bad.
Really good racist, unfortunately.
Really, unfortunately.
Very creepy guy.
Well, he's
very,
from the Goldwyn
well
family, so.
Yeah. And, of course, Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, who I will play. And... A character who, again, does not have a lot of lines, Sandy Irvin, but is sort of a hanger-on or a part of this group. This is a little dialogue that they have in sort of interrogating or doing an interview of Lockjaw. Bill is Virgil.
You know a black militant by the name of Perfidia Beverly Hills?
Yes, I do.
And was she a member of the rebel group known as the French 75?
She was.
Colonel Lockjaw, did you engage in a romantic relationship with this woman?
Gentlemen, I have engaged the enemy face to face in battle, in the dark alleys and shadows of espionage. I was once raped in reverse.
Raped in reverse? Could you explain how that might work for us, Colonel Lockjaw?
The enemy employed deception. I was drugged, and while unconscious, my brain was not working, but my power was, and I believe I was taken advantage of.
What kind of proof do you have? If you were unconscious, how do you know this to be true?
I don't know it to be true, but I suspect it. When I awoke, there was a sensitivity in a private place, and there was some residue of interaction.
Interaction?
I believe she was a sperm thief.
A semen demon?
That's correct.
Colonel Lockjaw, what would be the purpose of the enemy raping you in reverse?
They saw the power of my mind and body, and they desired it.
And so basically, this happens technically at the end, but what kicks off the plot is that he is trying to get into the Grossest Adventurers Club, which is like a white supremacist organization, and he's trying to basically scrub his past. And so he suspects, because he knows that Perfidia had a daughter and suspects it might be his. And so he needs to basically erase the evidence that he had a biracial daughter out of wedlock. And so that he needs to track down Willa. Is the daughter's name.
Yeah, spoiler alert, and again, the book was from 1990, so I don't think it's worth spoiling anything. the child is not the old hippie guy. The child is Colonel Lockjaw's.
Right.
The book sort of says the same thing. Now, the thing about the book is that there's no Christmas Adventurers Club. You know, he's just basically part of a squad that Reagan has. I think it's called like Drew 74 or something. It has like a code name or whatever. But he's just part of, you know, the war on drugs. Basically, that's how he's presented. There's no like explicit like secret group. It's just like Reagan's funding this. So, you know,
yeah, it's very updated. Well, it's as I said after I think it's like it's very in the zeitgeist. Most of the imagery and the references are very updated. Apart from the fact that it's clearly supposed to be the Weather Underground, everything else is updated for like 2025. And so, yeah, having like a goofy white supremacist club is very much something that would exist today. So they capture one of the other French 75 members. He basically is forced to give up what's going on. And so they head into...
He's the one who controls all. So we should also say the way that the French 75 communicates
through stupid bullshit.
So this is what I wanted to say earlier. When they were successful, they had their peak, and then they had their loss, and they kind of had to disperse. And basically, even after they've dispersed, they're just arguing with each other over minutiae, weird details, passwords, rules. And I was like, this feels like every other leftist organization I've ever participated in.
And you know what? I'm going to defend it because there's a scene in the film.
You're defending Comrade Josh.
Yes. Because
there's
a scene in the film where he's got to call, you know, into the number to get the information he needs to make the next step because he's on the run, whatever. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't know the proper code words. Now,
because he spent the next like 15 years.
Because he's a burnout.
Because he's a burnout.
He is stoned and paranoid now.
Well, okay, I see
and
why.
He is like a,
but like, if,
wait,
if,
why
if,
are
if
you
15,
not defending
if 15,
Bob
if,
here?
If 15 people were domed. In this 15 years ago, and you know people are on the run, and somebody says they don't know the password, you don't tell them shit. They got fucking AI deepfakes. You can't tell somebody on the phone where to go, what to do, what they don't know the fucking
password.
I think
if you had to argue with Comrade Josh, you'd change your tune.
I knew this opinion would not be popular.
So this is the scene where Bob has gone into, and I forget if he purchased or he's stole some huge sunglasses and he's out at a payphone, right?
Yes.
So Kirsten and Carl, on the count of three, could you maybe name a person in your life who Bob reminds you of very much?
Rob.
One, two, three. Rob Vanilla.
because he's even doing the Rob walk.
I thought I was looking at a spitting image of you, man, the entire time. Especially like when he's like driven and he's like, I know he's stoned out of his mind, but he knows exactly what he's got to do.
Yeah.
He's piecing it together.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
And he's booking. Also,
I just think you guys kind of look alike too, especially with the hat
on. Have you ever been watching Battle of Algiers and then you're smoking a joint and then you say, I'm getting fucking paranoid, man.
You know,
do you ever put on Steely Dan and say,
here's the thing, everything you're saying, I'm like, yeah, I do all this shit. I do all that shit. You're like, have I ever smoked a joint watching the Battle of Algiers? I'm sure I've done that. Have I ever put on a Steely Dan album? Yes, I have. I think you might have got my ass on that one.
I say it in the most affectionate way possible.
I know.
Have you ever wanted to see Rob be the sweetest father figure in the world? It's like, just toss on this flick. I don't know.
But anyway, so they extract, they know that Lockjaw's coming, so they extract Willa, and then they basically alert Bob, who, Ghetto Pat, Leonardo DiCaprio, his name's Bob now, and basically let him know, like, okay, we got Willa, but, like, you got to get out of there, and he's, trying to figure out how to do it, and he can't remember the password.
Yeah, what I didn't like here, I mentioned this to you, because this struck me as one of a few little, like, weird coincidences. She does escape a high school dance, Willow. It's Prairie in the book. But she gets given up by, like, her trans friend.
By her non-binary friend.
Come on.
Yeah. You can't. It's like,
There is a cool scene in the book. The daughter is whisked away. Prairie is whisked away by a woman who was part of the group with Frenesy, DL is her name. They make a bunch of jokes that I can't even remember now. But they whisk her away to the ninjets where the nuns are, same thing. And the way that in the book, the device that they use to start telling some background stories about what Frenesy was really like, which, again, they don't do in the film, is actually oddly through a lot of scrapbooks and videos because they were in a radical film collective. So she starts going through, she logs onto a computer, which I think is funny, and it's like dial-up. It was like the age of dial-up. It took her a long time to be able to get to the computer. So she finally has the full file or everything that the house and the group has on her mom. And this is the passage. The file on Frenesy Gates, whose entries had been accumulating over the years, often haphazardly, from far and wide, reminded Prairie of scrapbooks kept by somebody's eccentric hippie uncle. Some was governmental, legal history with the DMV, letterhead memoranda from the FBI enhanced by magic marker. But there were also clippings from underground newspapers that had closed down long ago. Transcripts of Frenesy's radio interviews on KPFK. And a lot of cross-references to something called 24FPS, which Prairie recalled as the name of the film collective DL said she and Frenesy had been in together for a while. So into it, and then on, Prairie followed, a girl in a haunted mansion, led room to room, sheet to sheet, by the perforated whiteness, the earnest whisper of her mother's ghost. She already knew about how literal computers could be, even spaces between characters mattered. She had wondered if ghosts were only literal in the same way. Could a ghost think for herself, or was she responsive totally to the needs of the still living? Needs like keystrokes entered into her world, lines of sorrow lost, justice denied. But to be any use, to be a real ghost, would have to be more than only that kind of elaborate pretending. I thought that was pretty good.
They've really analyzed the relationship between mother and daughter a lot closer than they do in the movie.
I guess that was one of the things, that dynamic between mother and daughter in the book is basically half the book.
Yeah.
And one of the things about the movie was, we got to keep this thing moving. We got a couple chase scenes we got to do.
Yeah.
So there is more chase scenes in the film. Mm-hmm. This is when we come into contact with my main man, Benicio Del Toro.
Yeah, he is, in my opinion, the best character in the...
I mean, that guy's cool de la.
Yeah.
And I did like this. There are some passages in the book when some of the women are training in Japan and doing them. And so that the fact that he's a sensei and sort of just brings that little aspect into it. Once I realized that, I did like it. But yeah, so he is a... He runs a gym,
a karate gym.
But he also runs a large family network that's like the Underground Railroad.
Yeah,
it was a Latino Harriet Tubman situation.
Exactly.
That's it. So now I don't remember how they met.
Willa went to that gym. So that's how they knew each other.
Right, he was her.
And
sensei.
So when Bob escaped, so. The Lockjaw, his crew break into the house. He escapes
through the longest tunnel of all time.
He smoked out, but he manages to.
Oh, that's right. There was like a smoke.
Yeah,
bomb.
Yeah. He manages to escape. Puts on his new sunglasses.
And it's unclear. It's like, does he know that Sensei is like involved in any of this stuff, or is it just like a guy that he trusts?
Yeah.
But he goes to the gym,
but that's really central to Sensei's character. So it
do you
want to
talk a little bit more about this arc, because I thought it was an interesting dichotomy between the French 75 type organizing and the sensei type organizing.
Yes. Second that Benicio Del Toro rocks in this, great character. So Bob is banging on the window. There are impending raids going on in the street outside.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of
kinetic.
Yeah. And like when we meet, Sensei's character, he's on the phone with his wife, I believe. And it's in Spanish, or she's talking in Spanish. He's responding to her in English. And she is clearly like agitated about stuff going on. And he's very cool, calm, and collected. And then,
because they're doing like full on raids in the streets, like there's protests.
And as we'll find out,
part of this is, I guess, what a family business or part of it. They have like a little shop as well.
Yes.
And so they're right involved with the community there. They see everything outside.
Yes. So she's like relaying that there's, you know, happenings afoot. He's like, oh, yeah, it's fine. I'll be home in a bit.
Hey,
Bob.
He's incredibly chill.
He's so chill. And then Bob comes in, is freaking out about. He's just talking a mile a minute, and
I am a Bob, but I'm trying to be a.
That's
why I go to therapy. I'm trying to do that.
But yeah, so he's like, "Oh, okay, yeah, well, come on, Bob, let's go," and just takes it in stride and takes Bob back to their small business with the apartment and like network of like places of refuge for immigrants.
Yeah, different hallways and tunnels. Like, it's very unclear what the geometry of
this building is. Some of the young guys know how to go out on the roof.
They have skaters.
As soon as I saw the skaters, I turned to Nurse Susan. I was like, these are the bad guys.
And then this sets up the cops visiting the business that Sensei's family runs on the first floor of this apartment complex / storefront. The cop says an incredible line about how he has to go kinetic because the kid doesn't let him in and is like leaving the storefront when the cop wants to be let in. Incredible. Like that really captured.
They know how cops talk.
That really captured cop speak.
Yeah. I mean, it was so there's like a protest of the
I laughed out loud
in
the theater
the street,
when
and
I
they,
heard
they
that
call
line.
In like they're
yeah, they
like,
have a fake protester.
Yeah. They call in like Led Zeppelin. Yeah. And then a guy just gets out of a car in a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. That's obviously an undercover cop and throws a Molotov cocktail.
Yes.
And I'm just like, oh my God.
So they have like a couple dozen like Hispanic immigrants who they are clearly sheltering, and they lead out to a church.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bring Bob into the back, and Bob is still trying to get the password.
His phone isn't charged. He's trying to get the password. He really needs a gun.
Agitated.
So he's asking about where the gun is. He's knocking
like somebody,
shit off
somebody
the walls.
Doesn't know the password.
His
they're asking for a circuited gun.
The audio setup. It was a whole mess.
Yeah.
There was a huge explosion in here.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that.
Ride the board.
We'll talk about that in the patrons only episode.
And then he sends Bob off with the skaters to like escape.
Mm-hmm. Bob takes a few steps. He's running on the roof and just fucking eats shit, falls off the building, breaks his fall by grabbing onto a tree. But yeah, he splats on the ground and gets immediately tased.
Captured.
Yeah, that's right. Tased.
Yeah, he was. He like, you see him hit the tree, hit the ground. You're like, oh, is he? What's going to happen? And he literally stumbles to his feet and he's immediately tased.
Yeah. And he's taken in. One of the skaters calls Sensei and is like, oh, they got Bob. And once again, cool, calm, and collected. And says, okay, like, meet me at the hospital.
That is possibly the most annoyed he looks in the movie, though.
Yes. Which,
fair enough.
He should have been. So
yeah, I mean, he was trying to set Bob up for success.
Yeah.
But he just didn't want to hear it.
Though, I mean, he should have known that Bob wasn't going to be real athletic, scaling the barriers and jumping on the roof and stuff. But yeah, so Bob gets taken in, and Sensei clearly has a plan because he tells his sons or nephews or whoever,
the skaters
who seem to be his family members, maybe. Or at least are like in community with him.
Yes.
Which is a theme, like everyone's in community with Sensei.
Yeah, because you can tell that everybody's in community with him.
Yeah.
And because it can't be all of his, because there was so many people, there was dozens of people sort of moving through this network.
Yeah.
You know, which was really neat.
Yeah. He knows so many guys.
Yeah.
And
women.
And well, yeah. And women.
The general.
Yeah. So he's put this plan into place clearly. And then we go with Bob, who is talking to the cop and giving fake names and sort of joking around. And eventually, the cop accepts one of his fake names, Jim Parker, I think. And then he is taken to a nurse for an initial evaluation. We find out the nurse is in cahoots with Sensei, who is like, oh, you are diabetic. Aren't you? Bob, aren't you? And says his real name. And he finally is kind of like, oh,
he's
comes out of his stupor a bit. Yeah. So she tells the cop, which also another great cop thing. They get the cop speak right. And they also get cop being stupid right here, because this is all happening right next to the cop. And he just like does not realize that she's calling him by a different name. She's clearly like orchestrating something. She pulls him and is like, oh, he has to go to the hospital. He's diabetic, didn't take his medicine. So she sends him along to the hospital. He gets there. Another nurse comes into his room and is like, all right, so, and takes off his, like, uncuffs him from the bed and is like, okay, so what you're going to do now is go to the bathroom and then exit that door and head out the fire escape. Again, a cop is right there and they slip him out. That nurse goes to, like, take forms to the cop to sign or something, and Bob slips right out, and Sensei is waiting for him with the car, and they're gonna head out.
Yeah, I mean, it was just so neat that it goes from him saying meet me at the hospital to this elaborate, like, he has this network set up to sort of have this network of nurses, which I mentioned to Nurse Susan, get this guy, have to like handhold him through the process of escaping and getting to the car, which was pretty cool.
And they finally know where to go.
Yeah.
And the reason they know where to go is because, not because he finally remembered the password, but because one of the guys that was in charge of Comrade Josh, who's the guy on the phone, is an old friend, and they had an inside joke.
Yeah.
And because he remembers the inside joke, that's what.
Yeah.
Still has to be another verification. There was still a verification.
Yeah.
So I think Comrade Josh was vindicated.
Well, but the thing is, like, I think both with Sensei and with the old friend comrade using the inside joke to verify Bob's identity, like, it, one thing I really love about the movie is that the real work happens through people's relationships, rather than with Comrade Josh, he's kind of like an annoying trope of a
we all know a comrade.
We all know. Yeah, someone who's very heavy.
Some of them have been in here.
Yeah. A theory heavy, like, white, self professed radical who could not get two people to show up to a meeting because he's inseparable.
But again, when you need OPSEC, that's your guy. That's your guy.
But yeah, so now Bob and Willa, they're both headed towards the nunnery. Willa gets there, but she had a phone with her, so they do find her. I'm speeding through a little bit because I think we're getting a little bit behind time.
Okay.
Lockjaw has now captured Willa. Bob is still like trying to get there, and like gets there and he's able to like shoot at them a little bit, but they do get away. But so this is now like the big reveal is like, oh, he's tracking her because he thinks she's his daughter, and I think they basically confirm it. It's a little unclear if he's doing it correctly, but it basically seems that it is. She
which
is
a nice, another nice homage to the book, because it's the same thing. It's a little bit ambiguous. It's said, it's stated, and it's probably true.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's ambiguous of the book too.
Yeah, and the casting though makes it pretty clear that it's supposed to be, because there's a scene where they're standing like face to face with each other, and like, oh yeah, they have like the same facial structures. And you get some more good Lockjaw dialogue about like daddy daughter games and so, all that stuff.
So corny.
He's a freak.
And uncomfortable.
And there is not with I guess a little bit with the daughter, but the dialogue with Brock Vaughn in the book is also, it's different. It's not as he's more sort of conniving. Like, this guy's more of an idiot. But it's very creepy. He has a weird, even when you read it, you read it in a certain way. He has a weird tick to him. Like, he'll go like, how will he do something? He'll be like, so you went down to the beach to see weed, and then are you sleeping with him too? You know, that kind of thing. It's very creepy.
In the movie, he does make the comment about how, oh, you should dress up if you're going to a dance. And
make yourself look better with makeup.
yes. Yeah. And I like that that was also tapping into the weird, I don't know, right wing idea that you need. Who was it who was like, oh, people need to put on suit and tie when you're going to the airport? You need to look nicer.
Secretary.
He's trying to overcompensate his masculinity, because I don't think he really has. I mean, he has like a very forward facing version of it, but I think in his dialogue he like overcompensates.
Yeah,
it's, I don't, that's how I took it.
He also has an amazing walk, which I don't think we mentioned.
I'm walking a little, or I've been walking a little like Stephen Lockjaw with
once
my,
you see it, it's kind of hard to not.
I got a pinch
it.
Nerve that's healing, so I'm kind of doing that.
You want to get to sort of the end, because I do want to talk about the end pretty extensively.
Yeah, so do you want to speed through to like rest of the plot?
Yeah, go ahead.
So he hands her off to a guy that he's been working with that's supposed to like kill her, but the guy says, I don't kill kids. So he's like, bring it to this other white nationalist group and they'll kill her. He does that, but then he's like, that's not good. So he kills all the white nationalists.
Which,
Willard
again,
escapes.
I must point out here, this is my second one. We had the non-binary person ratting. Now we have the noble savage,
the Native American
guy actually having the change of heart and spirit being moved, and sacrificing himself to save the girl.
Yeah.
Just putting there, another trope, because the guy's a Native American. He's like introduce him as like a Native American guy who's like works by himself, the lone guy.
I thought it was also Native American Mexican, which is why when the white supremacists, they call him like whatever a derogatory term.
They call him
like,
half.
And I think that was what kind of threw him over the edge. It's like, you're putting me down. So
I was fine
with you
killing this 16-year-old, but now that you're racist.
Which was a little bit odd. But anyway, that's how Willow escapes.
But yeah, so she escapes. At this point, the Christmas Adventurers have realized that Lockjaw has a biracial daughter, and they're like, you got to kill this guy.
Yeah, Kevin Tillman, is that how you say his name? The guy who plays John Locke's father in Lost.
Yeah.
Says to make it clean, you could eat off the floor or something.
Very creepy.
Yeah.
And so now the guy who looks like Tony Goldwyn.
Yes.
But
like
not,
the quarter zip.
Yeah. Yep,
guy.
Yep,
yeah.
Yeah.
Has now tracking down, because Lockjaw is driving away, gets tracked down, shot in the face, drives the car off the cliff.
Really great scene too, because he tells him to lower the window, and Stephen Lockjaw's like, oh, okay, yeah. And just lowers the window and gets blasted.
Kills him.
Or does he?
Right. Yeah. Well, this is what we'll get to, because I have lots to say about that. But the assassin from the Christmas Adventure is now behind Willow,
and it's unclear as to why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this seemed to be on the same road, but he's chasing her, and now Bob's coming up. He's found them, so he's chasing them.
Everything's got to be a chase.
This scene was thrilling.
Yeah, it was really
good.
Something so cool about going over the hills. It almost felt like it was so smooth that like you almost didn't feel like you were in a car.
Yeah.
Or something visually like that just.
Yeah, and that actually becomes how she figures out how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she outsmarts him, stops the car. He crashes. He doesn't have like the secret stuff. She shoots him. Bob comes up, rescues her. Hooray, we're at the end. And so there's, the two end scenes, which is one with Bob and Willa. And the one with the Christmas Adventures.
Yeah, so the one with Bob and Willow, it's just sort of like thrown in there. So there's some sort of resolution.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that at the end because I have a good.
So actually, Lockjaw doesn't die.
Fine.
He comes sort of limping out of this crash, bloodied and battered, but he's fine.
This is after Bob had inspected, because he was looking for Willa in the car.
Yeah.
And there's a chilling scene of him bright red, upside down, scalded, and you're like, yeah, this motherfucker is crispy. Yeah.
So,
but he's not.
So the end of him actually is, he goes to a nondescript office building in a, like a boardroom or whatever.
San Antonio or something.
Yeah, and yeah.
Houston.
And so the Christmas Adventure guys are there, and
You read out earlier happens.
The scene we read out earlier.
Then they convene
happens.
And then come to say, congratulations, welcome to the Christmas Adventure.
Yeah, they do not tell him that they tried to kill.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they don't tell him any of that. So they're like, look, after all this, we're going to take you to your new office. And they take him to this really nondescript, like, middle management office. I've been in that office.
And he is like a pig in shit. This is the greatest office he has ever seen.
So he puts
his
feet up on the desk, and then they release like a cyanide gas in there. He's dead. He dies, and then they just, you know, the guys in hazmat suits come and take him out of the office. And it took me a minute to think about that because I knew I liked it because it resonated with me. Just that, you know, they killed him in that nondescript corporate office that I've been in 1,000 times. But it's really the right. It was actually the right demise for his character because I was mad that he survived this. Like, why would he survive that? It's stupid. He actually just got killed silently in an empty office by like faceless freaks, you know, which is exactly what people are. It's happening to people downtown every day. It just takes longer, you know. And they have pictures maybe of their kids in the office, but it's the same death. He got the right death. Like he served these absolute pigs and freaks, and he died silently in an office with his feet up on like a mass produced Wayfarer desk or whatever. That's actually the proper that death makes sense to me actually in the grand scheme of it. That's how I took it.
Do you think that the incinerator was too on the nose?
Well, I mean, again, everything in this movie has to be like. You know, like just like cartoonish level stuff, and so I've after because I saw it about a month ago because it took me about 3 weeks to read the book too, and yeah, I finally came to like to accepting the fact that this is the kind of movie that it is. It's they played up the sort of the cartoonish aspects of it. They played up all the characters, all the racial stereotypes and all that stuff, and so I just had to like accept that that's a movie for people. It's not a postmodern piece of fiction, you know, experimental fiction or something. It's just not the same thing. It's loosely based on this story. And I think for all that, it's fair. And that's what really drove it home is thinking about him dying in that empty, just nondescript. Like you said, it could be in Kansas City. It could be in Columbus, Ohio. It could be in
Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah, there's tons of them right down the street. And just to literally die silently. In that office, that was perfect. Now, and just for the book, I can tell you how the book ends before you get to your ending. Actually, so the Lockjaw character is actually, he has commandeered a helicopter, and he's chasing Prairie in a car with a helicopter. And he's like dangling out of the helicopter, getting ready to apprehend him. And just at that time, Reagan rescinds all of this money. That's going, and literally as he's doing it, the helicopter turns around. They go this way with him yelling that he can't get her because they've taken away all his funding, and that's how it is.
Yeah.
So he's like they literally turn the helicopter around with him hanging out of it.
Before I get to my part of the end, what do we think? How much out of 10 for one battle after another?
You want me to go first?
Sure.
7.5. 7.5. I can't give it. I don't. Again, a part of it is I went into it not realizing exactly how sort of slapstick was going to get played up. So my first I've actually started to like it more the more I think about it. But I'll say 7.5.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at too. Because I did not like the first 30 minutes or so. Like I thought it was a little bit like for all the reasons I mentioned earlier.
Gratuitous, but, sort of like nothing.
Yeah. So. But like in terms of like it's a really well-made movie. The performances are great. The stuff with like Benicio del Toro, like all this stuff is really fun. So like honestly, for me, if they'd cut out the first 30 minutes, it'd probably be like an 8 or 9 out of 10 for me. But I still think it's a very, very good movie. Definitely. With just some weird elements.
I mean, I think I'm basically in the same wavelength, like a 7, I would say. Yeah, some things I really, really loved. But yeah, the first 30 minutes was just kind of both like discordant in its politics or like what it was trying to say, and also like tapped into some tropes that I was like, don't really love it. No.
I think you're an eight.
I will do you one better. I preface this by saying I do not watch a ton of movies these days, but especially in the theater. In fact, I think the previous flick I saw was at Ruben's recommendation. It was a Norwegian film about a woman going to live with her parents who are both dying.
Yeah.
I think I'll go. Sounds
like a Ruben film.
I think I was thrilled at the end, especially, and maybe that's what's clouding my good vibes here. But I think I'm like 9 out of 10, 5 bags of popcorn plus a pair of stolen sunglasses. I loved the father daughter kind of storyline that really pulled at my heartstrings, especially like when they reunite in the desert. It was pretty incredible. Yeah. And then just the last third, I was just like hooting and hollering at the chase scenes because it was so beautifully done.
I mean, yeah, you talked about them being chase scenes, but they're very good chase scenes.
They're so good.
Here's the thing.
And they're so suspenseful.
Very good. Yeah, I mean,
the camera work is really incredible.
Yeah.
It's really like, again, I don't see a lot of detail even in the theater, but I can enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I know what's going on. And just so I really see more about the lighting and like the mood. And I really did. I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it because like the stuff in the desert's real like bright. Most of the stuff, the lighting in that hallway.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff, the lighting, the real bad lighting in the office. You can see that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? That from scene to scene. I that kind of stuff I really liked. So I think 7.5 is fair. I enjoyed it.
Kirsten and Carl have given me a lot to chew on though with the first 30 minutes, which I, because when I first saw it, I was like, yeah, a lot of this stuff is way too on the nose. It's exploitative in a way. It reminded me of like, because I took like a anthropology of film class at some year in college. And it was like, oh, if I had to write an essay, it was like if a college student was writing an essay about this film, they make the issues to spot very easy.
Yeah.
Especially if you're reading it in conjunction with more of like the political history. It's like, oh, I could see the parallel here. I can see this is what this is referencing. Yeah. And maybe it's just like my age. Like,
it was designed for like Trump won like Tumblr discourse.
Yes, that's kind of how I perceived it. Oh, and then like maybe I'm more like post-tropey, if that makes sense. But it's like oh, sometimes you just have to make things very obvious for people, especially if they're younger and they're kind of learning about this stuff for the first time. But also, I just like people have incoherent politics.
Yeah,
that's sort of my other takeaway.
I think if you're gonna show the way that this group is operating so similar to the Weather Underground, then like you should explore that more. And yeah, I don't know. The fact that they did not really go into any, it was just like, oh yeah, this group is discordant and they are, they're breaking up to get, like, they're not, their social relationships are breaking up and they're like one person's ratting on everyone and they don't really, I don't know. Just like, I would want to see more. Because I think, like, the idea was that because at the end, like, Willa is now going to protests and being more involved and, like, has this renewed relationship with her father and they're bonding and connecting. Like, the second part of the movie is so clear that, like, those relationships and those, like, community associations are what's important to driving this work. And, like, that was obviously missing from the French 75, I think, was what we were supposed to take away.
But yeah, so I think we can sort of close it out. So the last scene is, yeah, Will and Bob are back home, and there's a letter from Perfidia to Willa, and it's like a nice letter about, like, you know, I'm sorry that I couldn't be there, and like, hope you're doing well, that sort of stuff.
So this was very weird to me.
it didn't feel earned at all.
Yeah.
Because she's exactly. been completely absent, and that was not what her character was. But yeah. that kind of gets into, back to the podcast, Mother Country Radicals, sponsored by Crooked Media for some reason.
I appreciate that you're making that so that's clear.
Yeah.
You're a Crooked Media.
Highlights Bunker, yeah. sponsored by Crooked Media.
yeah. You, we're in the network.
well, now that you say that, I mean.
Yeah. He's the son of two Weather Underground radicals and interviews like the daughter of Asada Shakur, interviews Chesa Boudin, who was briefly the DA of San Francisco, but is also the son of two of the Weather Underground people who were arrested in the Brinks robbery. And it's a very interesting interview because they're all like kind of mad at their parents. Like they all are like, feel a little bit weird about the fact like, well, you cared about the revolution more than you cared about us. And I think they've all gotten to the point where they've like internalized that and like come to appreciate it a little bit more. And that's also kind of what's happening with Willa, is that she is someone who's like missed out on her mom and like her dad was a burnout partially because of what all happened. But at the end, she is like reconciled herself to that and is now like actively participating in the same like revolutionary action that her parents were. Which is realistic to what all the kids of like the Weather Underground, like they were all also leftists. So I think it's interesting that like, you know, people could feel kind of bad about that, but still take on the mission. And so there's like the last piece of this, I took a screenshot of the transcript, is him talking about, you know, what does it mean to be the child of a revolutionary? And maybe that's how you reconcile having parents who care as much about fighting the state as they do about raising kids. Because for them, revolution is an inheritance, something passed on for future generations. Decades and centuries of work, plenty of mistakes, some regrets, some hope and rage, and in between, time for reevaluation, learning from mistakes of the people who came before, trying to do things better next time, to pass it all along for their kids and for generations still to come. And I felt that line kind of resonated with me as like, it's obviously not in the movie, but it felt almost like a takeaway of the movie is that to the extent that they had a line through from that the original 30 minutes to the end, it's like she comes from a line of revolutionaries. You know, there was this like network and family community family networks that brought this. And now Willa is like doing the same thing at the end. And so that felt like a good connection between the real life and the movie in a way that was a little bit more positive.
Maybe we'll record like 15 minutes for patrons. Thanks for becoming patrons. Thanks for listening to. We got tons and tons of feedback on the full Buxton episode, which is a free public episode and a patrons only episode. You have to listen to them together. I do not want to hear any criticism. If you're not a patron, and you have not listened to the patrons only episode. I don't want to hear anything about it because it's one piece, not. Just 45 minutes that everybody gets. You're special. You should have this. Send us money. We got to buy a new. I got to buy a new piece of equipment. Actually, three new pieces of equipment. Jesus Christ! Send us money. Left is best.